and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Good evening. You are tuning in to KBOO 90.7 FM. Up next, we have Sojourner Truth.
Open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, the G20 meeting has begun in Argentina. It is an international forum for the governments and central bank governors from the world's 20 largest economies. Also, Trump as the mob president, the plea of his former lawyer, Cohen, the possibility of a pardon for Paul Manafort and the Mueller, latest on the Mueller investigation. Also, criminalization of asylum seekers, the migrant caravan, tear gassing of children, and Trump whipping up hostility towards migrants. Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump has joined the leaders of Mexico and Canada to sign a revised North American trade deal. Trump gathered with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and outgoing Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto on the sidelines of today's meeting of the group of 20 nations in Buenos Aires. The revamped deal, which Trump calls the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, will replace the North American Free Trade Agreement. Trump has long raged against NAFTA. He says the new agreement changes the trade landscape forever. Lawmakers in each country must now ratify the agreement. That could prove to be a difficult task in the U.S., especially now that Democrats will control the House of Representatives come January. Already, Democrats and labor leaders are demanding changes to the agreement. Meanwhile, President Trump again lashed out at the investigation in which his former lawyer pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about a Moscow real estate deal he pursued for Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. Michael Cohen says he lied to be consistent with Trump's political messaging. Trump says Cohen is lying now. In a tweet today from Argentina, Trump said, quote, against all odds, he decided to run for president and continue to run his business, which he calls very legal and very cool. Critics say it may have been legal, but it wasn't appropriate for a candidate for high office. New York Democratic Congressman Jerry Nadler told CNN Trump repeatedly lied during the campaign about his dealings with Russia.
A candidate for president of the United States was having business dealings with a foreign government at the same time that foreign government was intervening to helped subvert the election on behalf of that candidate, at the same time that the candidate was a candidate, obviously. He was dealing with a foreign power, an unfriendly foreign power, and had personal business interests with a foreign power and lying about it to the American people.
President Trump abruptly canceled a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin whilst on his way to the G20 summit in Argentina. Trump said it was because of Russian aggression against Ukraine this week. Trump will meet with the Chinese President Xi Jinping to discuss easing trade tensions between the countries. Opening statements were given Thursday at the murder trial of a white nationalist charged with plowing his car into a crowd of counter-demonstrators last year and killing a woman. A prosecutor told the jury that James Alex Fields was angry after fighting broke out earlier that day between white nationalists who came to Charlottesville to protest the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee and others who came to protest against them. Prosecutors said Fields had driven all night from his home in Ohio to attend the rally in support of white nationalists. A former teacher of Fields has said he was fascinated by Nazism and admired Adolf Hitler. The prosecution said 3 months before the rally, Fields twice posted on Instagram an image of a crowd being struck by a car. They added that the people in the crowd were described by Field as protesters. A Japanese court today approved a 10-day extension of the detention of former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn. The Tokyo District Court said it had approved a request from prosecutors to keep Ghosn until December 10th for a further investigation of his suspected financial irregularities. Ghosn was arrested November 19th by Tokyo prosecutors on suspicion he falsified financial statements and underreported his income and benefits. His first 10 days in custody expires today. The court said it also approved a 10-day detention extension for another former Nissan executive, Greg Kelly. He was arrested with Ghosn on suspicion he collaborated in the alleged underreporting of his boss's income. A new report shows measles cases around the world surged about 30% between 2016 and 2017. A joint report from the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control showed measles outbreaks occurred in all regions because of gaps in vaccine coverage. There were an estimated 110,000 deaths due to measles in 2017. The CDC said rates of unvaccinated and exempted children are on the rise. The Western Pacific region, which includes countries such as Australia and Japan, was the only region to report a decrease in cases from 2016 to 2017. It's also the only region to achieve and sustain 95% or greater coverage of the first dose of measles vaccine since 2006. Some California lawmakers say they plan to introduce legislation next year to make medicinal marijuana tax-exempt. Medicinal cannabis proponents say the move would help reduce costs and bring medicinal pot in line with other prescriptions. Christopher Martinez reports.
Democratic Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco says his bill is about ensuring that low-income people can access their medicine.
We don't tax prescription drugs, so why should we be taxing medical cannabis? It just makes no sense.
But California's newer adult use of marijuana law levies new state taxes on all cannabis and cannabis products. The act legalized recreational marijuana for people over the age of 21, spawning a growing cannabis industry. Wiener says the Prop 64 taxes were designed to apply to cannabis in the commercial market, not medical cannabis that is not sold. Democratic Senator Nancy Skinner of Oakland will be a co-author of the bill. She says no-cost medical cannabis, pioneered by Bay Area dispensaries, has played a critical role in patient care.
Now we've okayed it for recreational, which is great, but we don't want to lose the fact that there is really an essential role of cannabis in health.
Wiener will introduce his bill when lawmakers convene on December 3rd. On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is our weekly roundtable, and I would like to welcome our panelists. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson, Director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. She's based in Mexico City, a regular contributor to a number of publications, including Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, and several Spanish language publications. She's also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura Carlson, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
And Jackie Goldberg, who has served in the California State Assembly. She also served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Before being elected to the City Council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. She's been an educator all of her life. Jackie, welcome, but you have some news. Please share. Is it okay to share it or not yet?
Of course it's okay to share it. Yes, I am a candidate in the upcoming special election to refill the seat for District 5 of the LAUSD Board of Education. And I'm running in the seat that was vacated when Ref Rodriguez had to resign after admitting guilt to money laundering.
Well, Jackie, I mean, it would be wonderful for the school system throughout Los Angeles County, one of the largest in the country, and for us all, for you to be back in there. So we wish you all of the very best in your campaign, and we really hope that you're going to stay at our weekly roundtable for as long as you can.
Okay.
I'm predicting you're going to win.
Okay, thank you. I have the same prediction.
Okay, Jackie Goldberg, congratulations. And Dr. Gerald Horn, who's the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, he's written more than 300, I was about to say. It seems that way, Dr. Horn, 30 books, including his most recently published works, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, and Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we're looking forward to hosting you when you are in Southern California this coming February. So our listeners should listen up for more information on that once everything is all settled, including the venue. So we are looking forward to that, Dr. Horn. We are going to start off our discussion on the G20 summit. Just some background here. Leaders representing the 20 largest economies in the world have begun meeting in Buenos Aires, Argentina, as part of the G20 summit, which opened on Friday, November 30th. This year, dominating the summit is the power struggle between the United States and China. Together, those two economies make up 40% of the world's GDP. So the outcome of what is being described by some as a coming Cold War between the U.S. and China has wide global implications. The form that struggle is taking now at the G20 summit is whether or not the China-U.S. trade war initiated by Donald Trump continues unabated or more time is bought for negotiations. Trump is feeling pressure within the United States from companies and farmers negatively impacted by his trade war. Other issues at the summit include the controversy of Saudi Arabia's prince Mohammed bin Salman there representing Saudi Arabia after a CIA report pretty much indicated that he was involved in the Khashoggi killing. The Washington Post journalist that was killed in an embassy, the Saudi embassy in Turkey, at least ordered the killing. And also the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen, which has led to the world's worst humanitarian disaster happening right now. And there are a bipartisan group in the Senate that are rebelling against Trump in that arena and are calling for a withdrawal of U.S. backing, U.S. support for the Saudi Arabia bombardment of Yemen. Also, U.S.-Russia tensions over the Ukraine happening, not to mention Putin's seemingly hold over Donald Trump, although Trump has canceled the sit-down meeting with Putin, at least a public meeting. Who knows what will happen behind the scenes. And also, a backdrop that doesn't come out that much, Argentina, the host nation, headed by right-wing Mauricio Macri, has its hand out for aid, given the Trump trouble the Argentinian economy is in. But in a victory for Trump, there was the signing of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which replaced NAFTA. And you can be sure the world leaders are being met by protesters. Also, I quickly want to mention that five leaders, the Washington Post says, who aren't Trump to watch are Russia's Vladimir Putin, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, Xi Jinping of China, Justin Trudeau of Canada, and Mauricio Macri. So we'll see how all of that goes. But let us hear a clip from Al Jazeera that gives us some idea of what's going on, including the protests that are happening there.
The mothers of Plaza de Mayo have been demanding to know the whereabouts of their missing children since they disappeared during Argentina's dictatorship 40 years ago. The G20 gives them a chance to take their message to a wider audience.
The city is under siege. It seems like we're under a curfew, but we made it here, and once again we call on world leaders to stop the policies that create hunger, poverty, and that hurt the working class.
They weren't alone. Thousands of people are promising to take over the streets of Buenos Aires on Friday.
In spite of these protests, this is a historic event for Argentina and an opportunity to be at the center of world affairs, even though there are several issues overshadowing the main objective, which is to build consensus on crucial issues like climate change and inequality.
Among them, the presence of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and a request by Human Rights Watch to investigate him over the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi's killing has strained relations between Saudi and the Western world. Emmanuel Macron says he's ready to talk to the Crown Prince about what happened.
I have always been very clear on the case of Saudi Arabia, and I will inevitably have the opportunity to discuss it with the Saudi Crown Prince on the margins of this G20 meeting. We will have the opportunity to discuss it among European leaders as I requested before the G7.
Donald Trump arrived in Buenos Aires on Thursday evening, ready to discuss the trade war between the United States and China. He's cancelled his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin after the seizure of Ukrainian ships by Russia at the Crimean Peninsula. This protester came all the way from the United States carrying a baby Trump balloon. He's been an activist opposing the U.S. foreign policy since the Vietnam War.
We would like the President of the United States to act a little bit more mature. If I was going to boil it down to just one statement, it would be that. We think it's asinine that he's on Twitter. We think it's asinine that he's petulant, that he picks fights, seems to want to take the smallest and lowest road instead of the highest.
The G20 begins proper on Friday. This mass yoga session was organized to help leaders concentrate on resolving their differences. The protest around Buenos Aires will remind them how hard that task is likely to be. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
Okay, so Laura Carlson, we'll start with you. I mean, it would be great if that yoga session really helped to bring world peace. I'm all for yoga. I think it's a task a lot more difficult, however. And Laura, just before we get your thoughts, some breaking news here. Jared Kushner has received Mexico's highest recognition for foreigners, the Order of the Aztec Eagle.
Yes,
go
we
figure.
Know that. There's been a huge outrage in Mexico. It's kind of the parting shot of a president who's been sold out to the United States government and the worst government in contemporary history in terms of Mexican interests. And people are just absolutely beside themselves. It's just such an insult as he prepares to leave office today.
Yeah, really. And so on the G20 summit, I mean, there's a lot going on there, a lot to unpack. And I wonder from where you sit south of the border, your thoughts. Trump is hailing, of course, the signing of the agreement with Mexico, the U.S. and Canada replacing NAFTA as a huge victory. And likely we'll say, well, that has meant that the summit has been a success, right? But your thoughts on the G20 meetings?
Yeah, I think I will focus on trade because, first of all, for this region, of course, the signing of the NAFTA was completely expected. It was absolutely necessary. That's why they went through the whole negotiations. And as I mentioned, this is Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto's last day in office. Tomorrow's the inauguration. So that's why today was the last moment they could possibly sign it. And Trump declared it the greatest trade deal ever, as he always does. But it's been noticeable the kind of the silence and the lack of enthusiasm in many ways on the part of the other two presidents. The Canadian president, Prime Minister Trudeau, is very concerned about about some of the concessions that they were forced to do, and especially Canadian citizens are even more concerned about those concessions. And Mexico also. He also is concerned about some of the points going forward. And then you have the fact that there's a possibility that it won't be ratified in the United States, because although labor and other progressive organizations have found some progress within the new NAFTA, particularly in terms of labor regulation in Mexico, that would create less exploitation and less unfair advantage for production. There's also getting rid of some of those investor state provisions. But there's still a lot to be done on it. And there's a Democratic House now, so the future of it is still uncertain. When we look at trade in general, of course, it's the less dramatic, you know, soap opera type issue on the table at the G20, but it probably has the farthest reaching implications. Most of it centered on that meeting, the bilateral meeting with Xi Jinping, which will be at a private dinner on Saturday. We've still got $200 billion of tariffs on Chinese goods, over $100 billion on U.S. And experts, and I would have to share this view, are not real optimistic that there will be a positive outcome or much progress to report from that meeting. And that mostly has to do with Trump's negotiating style. It's one thing to be the bully in strong-arm countries like Canada and Mexico that have far weaker economies and are historically so dependent on the U.S. market and U.S. investment. But it's another to go up against China, which is an independent economy and a strong economy and also a very different culture. The Chinese government does not take kindly to those strong-arm tactics. They know exactly how much leverage they have. So Trump saying before he goes into it, you know, playing hardball and announcing beforehand that he's not sure that he even wants a deal and that he's going to raise tariffs to 25% on January 1st because he thinks that it's probably not going to work. It's prophetic because that kind of negotiation probably won't work. The world is very concerned about this, especially Europe. We saw the IMF coming out with some strong statements about how necessary it was to make progress. But as always, we see a President Donald Trump that is incapable of taking into account a broader context or more far-reaching consequences. And the Chinese government again, is playing the long game. They've thought this through several steps ahead, and they know what their positions are. So we'll see what happens with that. There's some other interesting things going on with trade as well. They're going to Argentina at a time when now, you know, the right, and including the far right, has taken over the governments. And we have a Bolsonaro, neo-fascist in Brazil, and French President Macron has come out and said there will be no trade deal with Brazil if Bolsonaro decides to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. There's the side battles with Trump as well, with the European Union. So as I say, that trade issue will be a big one, even as some of those other issues may take the headlines in a bigger way.
Right. Thank you, Laura Carlson. And Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts. Again, there's a lot going on. Trump has canceled his sit-down meeting with Putin. Not surprisingly, we'll be talking later about Cohen and the latest in the Russia deal. And all of the controversy also around the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But your thoughts on the G20?
Well, I'm pleased to see that Merkel intends to take on the Saudi prince directly and challenge him. She's also bringing forth a strong stand about ending the terrible humanitarian crisis in Yemen caused by two warring factions of Islam led by two warring countries with each other. But I think Trump's effect has been to basically undermine all of these international organizations because they're for the first time at the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation, that's the APEC summit, there was no formal leader's statement, and that was because of the U.S.-China divisions over trade. At the G7 in Canada in June, ended in disarray. Trump retracted his endorsement of the joint statement. So I think what we're seeing is that Trump is continuing his plan of saying, I don't believe in collective action, I don't believe in international agreements, I don't believe in anything except America first. But unfortunately, his America first policy is a good part of why there's layoffs in the, not the only reason, but a good part of the reason. There's been at least $1 billion of additional costs to making some of the American-made cars because of the tariffs on steel and aluminum, and that's hurt Canada dramatically. Canada was promised that by our trade negotiator that if there was an agreement on a NAFTA Part 2, that the tariffs between Canada and the United States on aluminum would disappear, and that has not happened. So now Canada may have trouble getting its agreement okayed by its government, by its parliament, because the United States has backed off an agreement it said it would have. So I think there's a lot going on, but I'm not optimistic that there'll be any deals with China. I agree entirely what was just said, that China has always taken a long view, whereas the United States, particularly with Trump, but even before that, looks at things day by day. And so I think we're going to see that very little will change for the good. The issues of poverty in the world will probably get little talk. And also there's new concern internationally by economists that a failure to end this trade war between China and the United States could actually have a recessionary effect on economies all over the world, because globally there is a global connection now between many countries in the world, and as a result of that, when China and the United States, the two largest economies, go at each other, the fallout is often with poorer nations, and that's something, of course, that that Trump doesn't worry or care about at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Jackie Goldberg. Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, part of, we know there's a lot happening at the summit, the China, the power struggle between China and the United States continues. Also, part of the story happening there, Russia and the Ukraine. I mean, we just briefly reminding our listeners that in 2014, there was a U.S.-backed coup against a pro-Russia government there and replaced with a pro-Western government. Russia was very concerned about the Ukraine joining the EU, but also what that would mean with a growing concern about NATO breaking the agreement it had with Russia and cozying up on Russia's border. And also the Western governments refused to accept the referendum. We're told it was a referendum that passed overwhelmingly of people in the Ukraine to be part of Russia. So it looked at as though Russia just seized it. And now the Ukraine seems to be, you know, really stirring the pot, right, in terms of any conflict with Russia, that I'm assuming that Ukraine likely assuming that they would have the backing of the United States in any such conflict. Some alarm bells. Some people are running around saying, oh my God, this could be the beginning of World War III. But whether or not, you know, that is the case. So there's the U.S.-China, and then there's the U.S.-Russia, among the other developments at the G20 and concerns at the G20. Dr. Horn, your take on all this?
Well, it's not only the conflicts that you mentioned. The United States had conflicts with virtually every other power at that Argentine meeting. Recall that Mr. Trump basically criticized, if not denounced, the Brexit deal engineered by Prime Minister Theresa May. The Conservative Party thought that if it withdrew Britain from the European Union, it could negotiate some sort of free trade deal with Washington. But Mr. Trump basically poured cold water on that idea, contributing to the collective nervous breakdown that's taking place in Great Britain over Brexit, which may lead, quite frankly, to the toppling of Theresa May before the end of the month. Then there's the conflict with the European Union over tariffs, the conflict with Russia, as you mentioned, over Ukraine. The New York Times, which stands second to none in its antipathy to Moscow, conceded that the president of Ukraine, Petroshenko, engineered this implantation of martial law because he's behind in the polls for the March 2019 elections, and this was a way to crack down on his opposition. There's also the conflict with Russia over liquefied natural gas. I think that's really at the heart of the conflict between Washington and Moscow. That is to say, Russia sending natural gas to Western Europe and natural gas producers in Louisiana and Texas wanting to capture that market, and Trump is their front man. Then, of course, there's the overriding question of the trade war. The Wall Street Journal reports today that Mr. Trump might be blinking, that is to say, offering to engage in protracted negotiations with China in return for a few minor Chinese concessions. That does not sound like the bravado that Mr. Trump usually likes to exhibit. And there's the question of climate change. The final communique apparently is up for grabs now because Washington does not want to sign on to any kind of communique that endorses the Paris Climate Accord, which Mr. Trump says the United States will be pulling out of. But in any case, back to China, that's the most serious question in light of this encirclement policy that Washington is pursuing. There have been hints that China might stop purchasing U.S. Treasury bills. They purchased $1 trillion worth in recent years. If they slow down, that could not only wreck the U.S. economy, it could really hamper the global economy. I understand why Mr. Trump might be blinking with regard to this trade war, because it's really harming the U.S. economy. Keep in mind that leading U.S. corporations, including Starbucks, which opens a cafe every day in China, Microsoft, Apple, KFC, are all heavily invested in China. And note that the stock of many of these corporations have been going down in recent days and weeks. If you look at the BMW plant in Spartanburg, South Carolina, it was set up not only to sell BMW in the United States, but to export to China. But in light of the trade war, China is blocking the importation of many of these BMWs. And so BMW now is hampering production in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and heightening production in China. Then there are the soybean farmers, the major backers of Trump's presidential campaign. They're suffering because they're not able to sell their soybeans the way they used to into China. So I think that Mr. Trump is being brought to his senses by the logic of the global economy.
Yeah, and apparently there's a huge boatload of soybeans headed to Argentina as we speak to try to, you know, take some of that pressure off. And Dr. Horn, have also been reading that some of the world's luxury companies, Tiffany's for Juan but Hermes and others, are really worried about the trade war from the point of view of the that they're losing customers, you know, the Chinese tourists that are usually account for something like 40% of buying of the world, you know, some of these luxury houses, that has gone down. So there's another aspect of all this as well. Thank you for that, Dr. Horn. What we're going to do now, actually, is to take our station break now and then return the Cohen deal, the Mueller probe, the migrant caravan, and more. Our roundtable continues. Stay with us. You won't want to miss one word of it. Thank you. Diamond in the back, sun in the top, digging the scene with a gangster lead, gangster white wall. TV antennas in the back. You may not have a car at all,
still stand tall. Just be thankful for what you got. Diamond in the back, sunroof top, big in the scene with a gangster lean. Diamond in the back, sunroof top, big in the scene with a gangster lean. Drive a great big Cadillac. Gangsta white walls, TV antennas in the back. You may not have a car. Sisters, you can still stand tall. Diamond in the back, sunroof top, digging the scene with a gangster lean.
It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. And we're now going to turn our attention to things surrounding the Mueller probe. People might remember that Trump has dubbed it as a witch hunt, a hoax. It began in 2016 as an FBI counterintelligence investigation into alleged Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee computers. It came just after WikiLeaks released tens of thousands of stolen emails from Democrats, and investigators claim Russian hackers with ties to Moscow had been behind the intrusion and shared the emails with WikiLeaks in an effort to damage the campaign of Trump's presidential rival, Hillary Clinton. Then a second email dump followed just weeks before the November election. In October, WikiLeaks published tens of thousands of emails hacked from the account of John Podesta, Clinton's former campaign chair. Podesta blamed the Russians and claimed the Trump campaign knew about the hack. Of course, we all know Clinton lost the election, and Trump seems to be quite upset because he doesn't want anybody to think that it was because of any hacking that took place. Never mind, he lost the popular vote by over 3 million. But now there's a new development where the former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty Thursday to lying to Congress about a Moscow real estate project Trump was pursuing during his presidential campaign. This according to Voice of America and other media reports. Now, I have long thought that the smoking gun here was really corruption around money. And, you know, I really see Trump as a kind of a mob boss, a mob president. But to give some background of this, Trump's financial ties and history with Russia, let's hear this short clip from CNN.
The potential Trump Tower deal in Moscow, which Michael Cohen admitted today to working on as late as June of 2016, would have been sweet for Donald Trump. 250 luxury condo units, 15 floors of hotel rooms, the chance to name a spa after his daughter Ivanka. But as President Trump stressed today, that deal never went through.
That was a project that wasn't done for a lot of reasons. Number one is that I was really, not that I had to do it, but I was focused on running for president.
Before and since taking office, the president has repeatedly denied ever sealing any real estate deals in Russia.
I own nothing in Russia. I have no loans in Russia. I don't have any deals in Russia.
I have no deals.
I have no loans, and I have no dealings.
But it wasn't for a lack of trying. CNN and other news outlets have reported that while no Trump real estate deals inside Russia were ever finalized, there were attempts dating back at least 30 years.
He was invited there by the Russians in 1987, and he made a famous trip there, and he fell in love with Russia.
He tried very hard several times to do deals in Moscow. He said, we'll be in Moscow, it's inevitable we'll be there, but in the end, he wasn't able to do the real estate deals.
Biographers and journalists who've investigated Trump's business deals say Trump tried at least twice to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Along the way, the Trump Organization enlisted some interesting characters to help them. One is Felix Sater, a mob-linked felon turned FBI informant referred to in today's Cohen plea, who tried to facilitate the Trump Tower deal in 2016.
Felix Sater is one of the most enigmatic figures in the entire Trump-Russia saga, and we know he and his father both allegedly had ties to the Russian mafia going way back. Felix grew up in mostly in Brooklyn, in the Brighton Beach area, which was sort of the headquarters for the Russian mafia.
Why did none of those heavily hyped Trump real estate deals in Russia ever go through?
One problem that Trump always had was getting the approval of the Russian government. He was always concerned that the bureaucracy in the Kremlin was too time-consuming, that there was too much. That's one of the reasons he was so interested in cultivating Putin himself.
But Trump has made money from Russians. He sold this mansion in Palm Beach to a Russian billionaire for $95 million. And there was one business deal in Moscow that did succeed.
Russia is our partner in this endeavor.
In 2013, he made millions when he partnered with a Russian billionaire to hold the Miss Universe pageant in the shadow of the Kremlin.
All right, there you go. And Laura Carlson, I mean, given the latest news, too, about the outgoing government of Mexico giving this highest honor to Jared Kushner, part of what has come out, that Cohen has also said that Trump's eldest son and his daughter Ivanka, so that would be Donald Jr., didn't mention the son-in-law in particular, that they were involved in discussions on this Trump Tower in Moscow as well. But anyway, your thoughts on what this might mean, this Cohen plea deal?
Well, the fact that Cohen has admitted to concealing these efforts to build the hotel in Moscow indicates that as Trump's representative, they were well aware of the conflict of interest. And we now have this very complex snake's nest of information and of individuals within this investigation that just gets deeper and deeper. You know, he said the felonies involved with the hush money, and now this, and what will happen, and this will be the next phase that will even deepen it more, is that as we go into a Democratic House, the information of investigations taking place in the Congress will be added to this, and we can just expect that the list of individuals who are forced to plead guilty to lying, now four individuals, will continue to grow and include some big names like probably Roger Stone and others who have lied before before congressional representatives in testifying this. What we have basically is two parallel lines that are being established. One is the Russian involvement in the campaign, and the other now are Trump's business dealings. They're very well established by facts, and what the Mueller investigation will be focusing on as these parallel lines continue is to try to discover where they intersect. It's very likely that as the Democrats become more involved and there's more oversight and there's more investigation, those lines will eventually intersect. You know, a lot of people are already saying, if this were a normal Democratic system, this presidency would be in deep trouble already. And that's certainly true. There are many presidencies and leaderships throughout the world that have fallen for situations of corruption and of conflict of interest much less serious than what we already know about this investigation.
Yeah.
And I think that this will prove to be just the tip of what we will eventually know about it.
Yeah, and Jackie Goldberg, I mean, given also the other piece of Manafort, his lawyers basically feeding Trump's lawyers all of the discussions between them and the Mueller team, and Trump implying that he will pardon Manafort. And a lot of people were thinking, well, look, this entire Mueller investigation seems to be falling apart when that happened with Manafort. And then this Michael Cohen plea came forward. So just a lot of moving parts here. And a lot of people are saying, well, Trump clearly is not going to go down without a fight. But clearly, it's been like a mob presidency. I mean, given what, you know, Manafort came out in that trial, given what Michael Cohen is now saying, and who knows how deep the corruption goes. But your thoughts on all this, Jackie?
Well, I think that's who Trump always has been. I mean, he's always been a wheeler-dealer guy who you can't trust after you've made a deal with him. And people know that, which is why no bank in America would loan him money, why he had to go to Russia to find loans, and that this business that he's never taken a loan from any Russian group is an absolute lie, and I think increasingly will become so. But I think the thing that that happened with Michael Cohen's new guilty plea is that this is no longer about Stormy Daniels, you see. Mm. Now this is about something far more significant, in my opinion. And that is that he lied to Congress, and that he, by implication, says that Trump has been lying to Congress, too, and lying to the public. And I think that's very important. Trump's answers now become very important as well. He, you know, has been answering questions by writing them. And I'm fascinated by the notion that they said that his answers match those of Cohen's. I mean, that's quite an interesting way to describe how you answered a question.
Really?
To say that their answers match, which, you know, means, of course, that they probably had a story altogether before. I don't know. I think the thing that's probably the most fascinating is that Trump has gone from saying, we never did this, it didn't happen, I wasn't involved in any of this, to saying, it's perfectly legal what I did. I was still a candidate. I was running my business. It's okay. It's okay. But it's not okay to be running your business to try to get a Putin acceptance of something you want to do in Moscow while you're running for office and that very same country and very same person is meddling with America's laws. And the dates match up. You know, they've matched up this June 9th and this June 13th. The dates match up, and they go to the question that Trump keeps saying, no collusion here. Well, increasingly, it's hard to believe that there's no collusion here when these dates match up and when you have evidence now coming out that, in fact, dealings were going on with the Russian government while the campaign was going on, while he was running for office, and even after he got elected to office. So these are very serious, very serious issues, and I think they put things in perspective a little bit better. I think also the Manafort deal is that, you know, Trump would have a great deal of difficulty pardoning Manafort, because that could add to the notion of obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
When you pardon somebody who lies to the government, lies to the FBI, lies to Mueller, and you pardon that person, you are in effect saying that it's okay to lie to all these people to protect me, and that's obstruction of justice.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, it remains to be seen what Republicans will do about that, and how what Trump's base will do about that. But there also seems to be some doublespeak in this way. I mean, the Russians may be saying, well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Everybody knows that the United States interferes with the elections of others. We didn't hear Democrats being outraged on several elections in Haiti. that have been manipulated, or the recent thing in Honduras, a few times in Honduras that has been manipulated in other places. But putting that aside for a moment, there does seem to be more than a smoking gun in relation to some money corruption and Trump in relation to Russia. So I'm wondering your thoughts on all of this. And Dr. Horn, also, the Democrats now in control of the House, there's some power struggles going on there. And Representative Barbara Lee was defeated in her bid for a leadership job. And I wondered if you just had a quick comment on that as well, Dr. Horn.
With regard to the latter, it was a setback with Congresswoman Barbara Lee of Oakland, Berkeley, was defeated by Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of New York. Mr. Jeffries, as have many of the Democratic congresspersons during this recent period, has used the cudgel of youth as a way to gain power. He's 48, Barbara Lee is 72, and it was said it was time for a new generation of leaders. The problem is that Mr. Jeffries is a corporate lawyer with one of the major Wall Street firms before entering Congress, while Barbara Lee has been an anti-war activist. And so we cannot say that this was a step forward for progressivism, the fact that Mr. Jeffries triumphed. And we need to watch this idea of using youth as a way to mask a lurch to the right. Now, with regard to Mr. Trump's scandals, the plea by Mr. Cohen is significant. But at the end of the day, what might be even more significant is the fact that in the last 24 hours in Frankfurt, Germany, there was a massive raid on Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank, as you know, was lending to Mr. Trump at a time when he couldn't get loans from anywhere else. Supposedly, the raid was driven by concerns in Berlin that Deutsche Bank is also involved in money laundering, which may implicate Mr. Trump as well. Strikingly enough, a leader of the Federal Reserve had arrived in Germany at the same time that the raid was taking place, and it was wondered in the German press whether or not that was coincidence. In any case, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, incoming chair of the House Financial Services Committee, has pledged and promised to put a bright spotlight on Mr. Trump's ties to Deutsche Bank. And at the end of the day, that is what might be more troublesome for him.
Right. Thank you for that, Dr. Horn. And with just the few minutes we have left, we do want to draw some attention to what is going on, the militarization at the border, the tear gassing of migrants, a tragic situation going on, a humanitarian crisis, really. And Laura Carlson, I just want to start with you. You are on the other side of the border here, and I'm just wondering your thoughts on seeing those images of children being gassed, and Trump announcing that any migrants who enter the country between official points of entry will not have asylum claim. And people seem to forget the MS St. Louis, a German ocean liner in 1939. That tried to find homes for over 900 Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany, and the United States denied them entry, and a lot of them wound up dead in World War II death camps, in German death camps. So measures were put in place to protect asylum seekers, and this is just being thrown aside. Laura Carlson.
The images were devastating, and it was a point at which many people within the United States and certainly within Mexico felt like the government, the U.S. government, and a part of the society had crossed a line, a very dangerous line, in which you lose all moral compass by dehumanizing human beings, including women and children just looking for a place where they can grow up. You know, to the point where not only did he say he would deny asylum to cross at official points of entry, which is against the law, against international law. They're allowed to request asylum at any border crossing when they're fleeing persecution. But he also authorized the use of deadly force against unarmed refugees who are fleeing from persecution, violence, and life-threatening conditions. I think it's a very, very good moment to recall the St. Louis and what happened at that time, because again we're seeing a situation where we're creating a world perhaps not as dramatically illustrated as a ship unable to dock and leave human beings and families in a safe harbor. It's a little bit more invisible the way it is now, but we're also creating a situation in which the doors are closed all over the world for individuals who just need a safe place to live and to raise their families, and the possibilities that they will die again, maybe not as clearly monitored or even well known as the way in which more than 200 members or individuals that were on the St. Louis ended up being killed. But they will be killed, and we know that they're killed oftentimes when they're sent back to their home countries.
Right. That's
the situation we're facing.
Right, and Jackie Goldberg, just very quickly, I mean, today it's reported that some of those asylum seekers have begun a hunger strike. You're on the other side of the border, you know, in California. Also, two immigrants have died in immigrant detention centers in the United States relatively recently. Just a quick thought from you, Jackie. Jackie, I don't know if we've lost Jackie Goldberg.
The Doctors Without Borders people have been surveying and helping those people, about 500,000 who flee from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, largely because of American policies and past history in those countries. We create the problem, and then we say, when you flee the problems we created, you're not welcome here. 55% of Salvadoran refugees say that they are victims of blackmail or extortion. 56% had a relative who died due to violence. 67% said they never feel safe at home. And 92% have been treated by mental health teams because they've lived through violent events in their country of origin. These are refugees who are entitled by international and American law to have an opportunity for coming to this country in order to get away. But then you have Sessions, and of course, what does former Attorney General Sessions say? Survivors of gang and domestic violence no longer have grounds to apply for asylum. This is not legal internationally, and yet we're doing it nonetheless.
That's
right. I think
right.
It's part of this cruel strategy of separating parents and children to deter families. It's part of a cruel strategy that says we'll create the conditions in your countries that make you refugees, and then we won't allow you to seek asylum.
Right. And Dr. Horn, just 30 seconds. I mean, it is ironic to see images of migrants rushing the border and the history of that border, because this was all part of Mexico.
Really?
Dr. Horn.
Well, that is correct, and perhaps even more troubling is the fact that Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, in a recent interview in The Guardian, reprimanded European governments for being too kind
That's
to
right.
immigrants and letting too many in, and not mentioning the fact support for wars in Libya and Iraq, and of course the Afghan war as well, was a major driving force, driving people out of their countries into Europe in the first instance.
Right, okay.
That's not the kind of leadership that the Democratic Party needs right now.
Right, we're going to have to leave it there. Another fascinating roundtable. I'd like to thank all of our panelists. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott, that's me. I'd like to thank the team today, our board op, Teddy Robinson, assistant producer Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del